From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. 92 to go for our sponsorships for Children's International, with Christmas right around the corner. So get to the website, coasttocoastam.com. Click the blue Children International button. It'll take you straight to their website, and you can sponsor a child for just pennies a day. Here's what's happening. Health officials are recalling hundreds of thousands of doses of swine flu vaccine after tests indicated they may not be potent enough to protect against the virus. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention notified doctors about the recall. The recall involving about 800,000 doses made by a company called Pasteur. The doses are pre-filled syringes intended for young children ages 6 months to almost 3 years. And the Senate has rejected a plan to import low-costing drugs. Yep, they've rejected the plan to allow you to import low-cost prescriptions from abroad, handing drug makers a victory that may also help secure passage of President Barack Obama's health care overhaul program. Now, the president had supported the measure as a senator, but his administration echoed safety concerns raised by the pharmaceutical industry, which is supporting the Democrats' health care bill. Al Gore, the former vice president, said new research showed that the Arctic could be completely ice-free in 5 years, but the scientist that his estimate was based on denies the timeline. The former vice president, who became an unlikely figurehead for the green movement after narrating the Oscar-winning documentary An Inconvenient Truth, became entangled in a new climate change row. Authorities moved thousands of villagers from harm's way near the Philippines' most active volcano after it oozed lava and shot plumes of ash, and said they probably would spend a bleak Christmas in an evacuation center. State volcanologists raised the alert level on the cone-shaped 8,000-foot Mayon volcano overnight to two steps below a major eruption after ash explosions and dark orange lava fragments glowing in the dark trickled down the mountain slope. Nearly 50,000 people live in a five-mile radius around this mountain, and authorities began moving thousands of them in case it erupts. I had producer Lisa Lyon check in with Art Bell today, and she did not get a hold of him, but we assume that he is out of harm's way. Robert Trumbly, RB, is a PhD, founder and principal, and researcher. He's a volcanologist as well and an award-winning scientist. He's traveled all over the world working on volcanoes. RB, can you tell us a little bit about this volcano in the Philippines?
Yes. Hi, George. Thank you for having me on your show again.
Sure thing.
Well, this is a re-eruption of Mayon volcano. It first erupted on the 15th of September of this year. But lately, it has been showing and getting more active, showing what are called Strombolian-type activity and ash emissions, as you just said. It has continued to erupt lava and ash, as you said. Thousands of people have been evacuated from the surrounding towns and villages. FIVOLCS, the Philippine Institute of Volcanology and Seismology, has reported glowing lava fragments continually being ejected onto the upper and middle slopes of the volcano. In fact, there is a possibility of a major explosion. The head of the disaster relief for Eastern Bicol region told reporters yesterday that the ash explosions had reached heights of 1,000 meters.
Jeez, what does your software say about that area?
We forecasted Mayon for 52% probability of eruption this year, so that was a hit for us. We've had 60 eruptions this year so far.
60. And anything going on at Yellowstone, Robert?
No, everything is fairly normal at Yellowstone. Okay. Everything is kind of quiet there.
Okay, and your website, still the SWVRC.org, right?
I beg your pardon?
Your website, SWVRC.org?
No, it's INTLVRC.org. It is correct on your website.
All right, good.
Yeah,
good.
It's the International Volcano Research Center. We changed that about 2 years ago.
All right, very good.
So, at any rate, about 50,000 people, well, they've moved out 20,000 people so far from around Mayon, ultimately around 50,000 people, as I believe you mentioned, need to be evacuated.
All right. Very good. Thanks, RB. Appreciate you being on the show and that update. We will monitor that situation all week long. In Virginia, a Louisiana County man who pleaded guilty to killing his wife after an argument over Christmas lights has been sentenced to life in prison. Prosecutors say that the 54-year-old man shot his wife once in the head with a .22 caliber rifle in their home in January. He had wanted to take down their Christmas lights, but the wife had opposed the idea, so he killed her. Oral Roberts, a pioneer in televangelism who founded a multi-million-dollar ministry and a university that bears his name, has died. He was 91. Roberts died of complications from pneumonia in Newport Beach, California. The evangelist was hospitalized after a fall on Saturday. He had survived two heart attacks in the 1990s and a broken hip in 2006. I was looking at some old YouTube videos of Oral Roberts when he was much younger doing his healing. You know, intense. I mean, thousands of people would show up, and he would bring them forward, and he would heal them. Tells you about the power of the mind when you believe. The risk of cancer associated with popular CT scans appears now to be greater than previously believed, according to two new studies published in the Archives of Internal Medicine. The findings support caution against the overuse of CT scans and other medical technologies that use radiation. The studies also bolstered the rationale behind controversial new breast cancer screening guidelines, which pushed back the recommended age for annual mammograms to 50 from 40. Mammograms also use radiation, but in smaller doses. And tea and coffee drinkers have a lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes, according to another study. The protection may not be down and because of the caffeine, since decaf coffee apparently has the greatest effect, say the researchers. They looked at 18 separate studies of coffee drinkers, nearly a half a million coffee drinkers. This analysis revealed that people who drink 3 or 4 cups of coffee or tea a day cut their risk by a fifth or more. The same amount of decaffeinated coffee had an even bigger effect, lowering risk by a third. The Monroe Institute, we've talked about it before. It's an amazing place where people have been able to learn, study, and even find out their inner self. In a moment, Paul Rademacher joins us, a spiritual hitchhiker's guide to the universe. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. For more than 25 years, Paul Rademacher has been studying the intersection between consciousness and spirituality. In 1997, he attended, for the very first time, the Monroe Institute and continued as a student there until 2000. In 2001, he became a residential facilitator at the Institute, leading groups in experimental explorations of their inner awareness. Since October of 2007, he has served as the executive director of the Monroe Institute. And here is Paul Rademacher. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you, George. It's great to be with you.
My pleasure. Many, many years ago, I picked up a book by the late Robert Monroe about his out-of-body experiences. And I got to tell you, I was riveted by this man. And one of a kind. So I guess he started that institute shortly thereafter, right?
Well, the institute started back in the 1970s, actually. And it was an outgrowth of his work when he started having spontaneous out-of-body experiences back in the 1950s. And he got so curious about it. At first, of course, he was terrified by the experience, but he got so curious about it that he wanted to see if there was some way that he could use what he knew, which was sound, because he was a radio person. At one point, he was the vice president of Mutual Broadcasting System, and he knew sound, and he wondered if there was some way that he could begin using those sound patterns that he developed to not only help control his own out-of-body experiences, but also to help other people to begin to explore those ranges of awareness as well.
I think, if I remember the name of his book, wasn't it called Journeys Out of the Body?
The first one was called Journeys Out of the Body, and the second one was called Far Journeys, and then the third one that he wrote was called Ultimate Journey.
Exactly. Just a wonderful... And then once he passed on, though, thank God you folks have kept the torch running. Was it difficult without him, or how did that happen?
Well, when he died in 1995, his daughter, Lori, took over as executive director and president of the Institute. She ran the place until her death in 2006, and then they started looking for a new executive director, and that's how I came into the picture at that point. But one thing that has amazed us, I think, right from the very start, is that through all the ups and downs and all the twists and turns of the story of the Institute, it's very clear that there is some kind of a very special guidance that is keeping the place running, because it doesn't seem to matter who is in charge. The work continues, and lives get transformed, and miraculous worlds start to open up for people.
Absolutely. Now, tell us about when you became interested in the study of spirituality and consciousness. What led you to the course? What led you to this field?
Well, you know, it wasn't a choice on my part. Back in 1981, my brother and I had a construction company, and I was working up on the roof of a house we were building, and I was trying to pull on a board to straighten something up, and all of a sudden the board gave way, and I found myself falling off the roof, and I landed on a pile of gravel, and didn't realize it at the time, but I fractured my left hip. We had a crane there that was helping to lift things up to the roof, and I missed the base of the crane by about 6 inches with my head. But they took me to the hospital in an ambulance, and when I got there, they took some x-rays of the hip, but they didn't find anything wrong with it. And so they put me in physical therapy, and which, if you have a fractured hip, is about the worst place you can possibly end up.
Oh, God, yeah.
It was awful. So the doctor came by after a while and looked at me, and he said, you know, you don't look like you're doing too well. And I said, I'm not, doc. And he said, well, let's take another look at that hip. So they took some more x-rays, found out that there was a fracture, and so then they took me out of physical therapy and put me into traction. And when the doctor came and told me that I was going to be off work for a number of weeks, I went into this spiral of pain and anxiety. Pain because the hip was absolutely excruciating. But anxiety, too, because this was the busiest time of our year, and there was no way I could possibly be off work. So I felt myself going downward, not in a metaphorical way, but in literally felt myself spiraling out of control. And then all of a sudden, I broke through to another dimension, another reality, another world entirely that I knew nothing about whatsoever. And in that other world, the pain that I felt in the hip vanished completely. The anxiety dissipated. I found myself surrounded by complete, total, and utter peace. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that there were no such things as accidents. Everything had meaning and purpose and was filled with wonder and magic. And then at some point, I found myself standing in front of a being of light, and we're conversing about my life, but we're not using words. It's kind of a telepathic communication. And when this happened to me and it came out of the experience, I was absolutely stunned because, you know, I hadn't studied this kind of thing. I hadn't done any kind of meditation. I was a terrible meditator in the few times I tried it. But it was such a stunning experience to me that it literally changed my life from that point on. I had been wrestling with a question before that as to whether or not I should go to seminary because I had a real strong sense of calling into the ministry. But when I had that experience, it felt like it was the voice of God to me, and I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that I should go to seminary. And I thought maybe that was primarily the reason for that experience. But what I found out over time was that the real reason for that experience was to create some kind of an enduring hunger in me to want to get back to that world again and to understand it more completely. So that's been my life work ever since, and I did end up spending 15 years in the ministry, but a couple of years into the ministry, I too ran across Bob Monroe's book, the second book for me, The Far Journeys, and I couldn't put that thing down because here for the first time was someone who was talking about my experience.
Yeah, exactly. And you seem to me that you've always been a believer in something which is important. You know, sometimes I even question what I'm believing in, but I do believe that there's a higher power, that there's this consciousness, and there's just some remarkable things we can do when we tap into this. It seems like you have always felt that but you were looking for a direction. Is that pretty accurate?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if that's accurate or not, because I think for me, what was more compelling than belief was experience. You know, when I fell off of that roof, when you have an experience, it's a different category of knowing somehow than believing something that someone has told you, you know, that, or getting something from secondhand knowledge or hearsay. It seems like when we experience, or at least in my case, when I experience it, that it has a much more compelling aspect to it. And I think it's the experience that I was after from that point on to, again, to really connect with that other world. You know, people can tell you that, oh, my gosh, there are these mystical realms that you can visit, but until you actually enter into them yourselves, you know, it's just kind of a wives' tale. But when you go for yourself, boy, it changes everything from that point on. And that's really what we kind of specialize in at the Institute is to create a context in which people can experience for themselves so that gradually, they can, over time, that they can begin to convert their beliefs into knowns. And that's kind of the way we tend to look at it.
How green, Paul, are some of the people, students, I guess, when they come into the Institute?
Well, you know, they're all stripes of people, and you know, we get people from all over the world who come here. There isn't a program where we don't have people from Japan or from Europe and you know, South America. But there are also all kinds of experience levels as well. Some people, it never ceases to amaze me. Some people come knowing nothing about the Institute, having very little experience in this, and sometimes they can have the best experience of all because they have so few preconceptions about what's going to happen. But then we also get people who have had years and years of experience in terms of meditation. I remember one story about a couple of Tibetan monks who came here years ago, and one was about 90 years old, and his assistant was about 70 years old. And these two guys would go into the booth, and they would listen to the exercise, and then they would come down, and they would be very quiet. And they were always dressed very properly with ties on. One time they came down, and everybody knew something was really up because their ties were loosened just a little bit. And the old man says, "Oh, you Americans, we meditate 15 years to get to this place. You do it in 3 days."
Yeah, but you know what? I'm not sure who was right. You know, I think the Tibetans, the monks, probably had their act together, don't you?
Absolutely. I have tremendous respect for not only Tibetan monks, but for, you know, the vast range of different ways of approaching this world. You know, what we do at the Monroe Institute is just one of many, many methods of getting to the same place. It's a method, though, that seems to work pretty well for our time and our culture.
Do people come in wanting this to work, Paul, for themselves, or are they a little skeptical?
I would say that most people come here because they really do want it to work. They know in their bones that something is missing in their lives, and maybe they can't quite put their fingers on it, but there's something that's driving them, and they want to experience for themselves. There are other people who come who are skeptical, though. I know we've got one guy who owns a company, and he's probably sent about 60 of his employees to go through our program. And I know that a number of those employees really don't want to be here, but it's amazing how many of them start to slide into the process and get a tremendous amount out of it, despite what their preconceptions were.
Yeah, I guess initially the boss is sending us here. We're here for a couple days, and they fight it. Yeah, that would be interesting to see them after the course and to see how they've changed.
Yeah, and in fact, we just had a few going through this last week here, and it is what's really interesting is to see the changes in people's faces when they come in. You know, we live in a very stressful society, you know, people are sleep deprived, and you can see it in their faces. You know, the lines and the weight, and by the end of the week, it's amazing. It looks as if so many of them have lost maybe 10 years or even 15 years of age as you look in their faces. So there's an impact on the internal world for sure, but that seems to have an impact on the way that people present themselves to the world as well.
I think so, too. Paul, we're going to continue talking about A Spiritual Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And the website for the Monroe Institute is monroeinstitute.org. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, a couple ideas for you. First of all, if you're not subscribing to the After Dark magazine, you can do that by calling 1-888-727-5505 or also go to coasttocoastam.com. Also, if you would like to sign up for Streamlink and get podcasting downloads, if you've got an iPhone, it's a great application as well. You can do that by going to coasttocoastam.com and click the link down there for Streamlink. Two good gifts. Two great parts of Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We've got Paul Rademacher with us. He is the executive director of the Monroe Institute and also author of A Spiritual Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe. Tell me a little bit about this book and this work, Paul. How did you set it up?
Well, one of the things that I began to realize that because of my own experience because of when I started coming to the Institute as a participant, was that this idea of experiencing the world beyond the physical world is really key to understanding, I think, that any religion, because at the base of all the religions, there is this mystical element that most people don't understand, because most religions have begun because somebody has moved from the physical world in the five sensory dimension into another realm, and then come back and try to tell other people about that. And that tends to be the beginning of what the followers then think of as the religion. But what so often people don't realize is that the words that the person uses, the explorer who's gone out and come back, don't really capture the essence of the experience. And so people fall in love with the words and the writings, but they forget that it's the basis of the experience that is really the profound aspect of it. And when I started looking at this, I began to think that, when Jesus was talking about the kingdom of heaven, I really think that he was talking about something that's accessible to us in this time and age and in this lifetime, because he would say things like the kingdom of heaven is among you, or the kingdom of heaven is within you, or some of you will not taste death before you see the kingdom of heaven coming in its glory. So for me, if it's some kind of a present reality, I think that it's most easily and best understood as a shift in awareness or a shift in consciousness that is available to ordinary people in the present moment, not necessarily something that we have to wait to die for before we get an understanding or come in contact with it.
Let's talk a little bit about infinity and eternity. Mm-hmm. Which you have this distinction in the book.
Right.
Your thoughts?
Well, eternity tends to be something that the contemporary church is very concerned about, and that has to do with the issue of, where are you going to end up when you die? Are you going to go to heaven, or are you going to go to hell? And the dividing line between those two shifts depending on what denomination you're a part of. If you're a Catholic, have you kept the sacraments? Have you gone to the right church? If you're evangelical, have you named Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior? If you're a mainline Presbyterian, have you been basically good? And on and on. And so that issue of eternity tends to dominate the conversation. But I think that there's another issue, and it's captured by this word infinity, which is different from eternity. Infinity has to do with the experience of the non-physical world that completes who we are as people. I think this has been something that has been a part of indigenous cultures from the beginning of time. There's always been a recognition that there's the physical world, and yet there's also this metaphysical or spiritual world as well that is equally important, perhaps even more important than the physical world. In our contemporary society, because we are so dominated by the scientific perspective, which recognizes that the only thing of legitimate inquiry is the physical world, we're kind of living half lives and not really even realizing it. There is a fullness that's available to us when we start to move beyond the confines of the body and begin to embrace this other world that is full of magic and wonder and insight and intuition and guidance. And I think that that's really crucial to us at this time.
It's critical. It's critical. And you don't need to be particularly religious to have these beliefs, do you?
No, and I think a lot of people today make the distinction between being religious and being spiritual. And the way they define that is that a religious person is someone who holds to a particular form of dogma and a belief system, whereas someone who is spiritual is really more concerned with moving into these experiential domains. I happen to think that that distinction is a little bit overworked because, as I said before, if you look at all of the traditions, at their basis, at their beginning, is this mystical experience. And I think because we have forgotten that, I think we have lost the real impact that religion can have for us.
Oral Roberts dies today at 91, and then I was just doing some checking of people in that field, healers, and there was another person by the name of A.A. Allen who died back, I guess, around 1970, who either died of a heart attack or died of something caused by drinking too much. And I was looking at some clips, Paul, on YouTube on these folks, and, people would come up, cripples would come up, people who had afflictions would come up, and I mean, I don't know if there was anything wrong with them when they came up, but when they walked away, they sure felt like they were okay. And, it was very, very strange. I mean, Oral Roberts had a little boy who couldn't walk without crutches, and he came up. He hobbled his way up, and he sat down, and Oral Roberts started playing with his legs and moving his feet, and the kid got up and walked away without the crutches. And I'm watching this and going, do you believe it or don't you? And if you don't, the whole thing was a setup. All these people were used. They had planted people in the audience. And if you do believe it, it's truly a miracle. And I'm pulling myself because I don't know which is which. I guess in the spiritual world, one would think it was a miracle, but I don't know. What do you think about something like that?
Well, I don't think there's any question that there are different forms of healing that can come to us. Certainly there's the traditional Western medical model, and then you've got all of your Eastern forms of healing as well that have more to do with an energetic basis than the Western model. And then, of course, you've got faith healing, as you've mentioned. And I think that healing can happen to us in any number of different ways, and I really wish that I understood it better. But even in the work that we do here, we can see things that can be healed for people, even when we're not trying to. So, I think that there's a great mystery out there, and part of the problem is we tend to make up our mind beforehand without actually exploring it. But if we give it some space and allow ourselves to be open to some of these things, I think we can discover some pretty miraculous stuff.
Through the Monroe Institute. What's the main mission here? What do you want to accomplish with people that come in?
Well, I think that the main thing, and this is, we only have really one piece of dogma that we ask people to consider, and that's the possibility that they might be more than their physical bodies. We don't try to tell them what that more might be.
Okay.
But we try to create a context for them to explore on their own, and we provide a series of tools to help them in that exploration. And when they experience that for themselves, then there's a tremendous number of things that can happen for people. Some people do have a healing at a physical level. Some people have a healing at an emotional level. Some people can move beyond the confines of the physical body and begin to explore and experience non-physical realms. Some people can encounter those who have passed over to the other side through death. The possibilities are really unlimited. So I think what we're trying to do is to crack open that possibility for their own exploration so that they can decide and discover what's best for them. Because one of the things that we found is that there's a process that happens independent of what we hope or think. And that process is almost inevitably perfect for the person who's coming through the program. Just to give you an example, my brother went through about 10 years ago to the Gateway Experience and had a series of revelations as he explored into really incredible realms. He decided to come back and take the course again just about a week ago, but his experience was totally different from what it was the first time around, even though it was the same course, which is just an indication that each of us has this tremendous guidance that we can trust almost implicitly mm-hmm. as we move through the process. We just learn to trust that very, very clearly in what we do.
Does it help also pull out that intuition that we all have, these different abilities that in some ways are suppressed for whatever reason?
Absolutely, and that's another key thing that we hope will happen with people is that they will get in touch with their guidance and get in touch with their creativity and get in touch also with their a real purpose in life that has tremendous meaning for them. And I think once we start to open up to these other realms, that so many different things like that can happen. And that's what's really key here is to let go of some of the preconceptions that we have and simply entertain possibilities that we might not have considered before.
People, you talked a little bit about how people are under stress these days. And, you know, you add in the economic mess. You add in other different problems that everybody has because we're all human beings. What can they do to find themselves and to pull themselves out of this mess that they're digging themselves in? Because I see it, Paul, every day on people's faces. I mean, they're uptight. They need to chill out. And I mean, I've never seen it so bad. And especially this time of year, you're supposed to be, you know, if at any time, this is the time of year you're supposed to enjoy yourself and the people you care about. And it's happening with some, but not a lot.
Right.
How do they pull themselves out of it?
Well, I think it begins with learning how to relax. And that's one of the first things that we do here is to allow people to let go of some of that tension that we hold so tightly in our bodies. So, for instance, we go through teach people how to relax progressively through their bodies in one of the first things that we do here. And it's that relaxation of the physical structure that is really the door that begins to open everything else up. When we learn to relax, then we can also begin to explore realms that would ordinarily be blocked off from us. If you think about when you go to sleep at night and you get more and more progressively relaxed, what happens is you come up to this threshold where you suddenly lose consciousness. You forget that you have a physical body. You go off into these other realms that sometimes we call them dreams, sometimes lucid dreams, sometimes visions. And then we come back and we remember them as dreams, but we don't often remember a lot of what else went on during that period. So what we help people to do here is to get progressively more relaxed, and then we also help them to maintain their waking consciousness as they cross over that threshold into what would normally be sleep or states of deep meditation. And so in keeping that waking awareness, then this whole domain becomes open for exploration, and it's when we do that we can receive an incredible amount of information that is truly valuable for our lives that can have a tremendous impact, not only on levels of stress, but also a tremendous impact on our what we want to do with our lives and also connection with guidance and connection with non-physical realms and tremendous opportunities for exploration.
Tell me about this word, this key word, enlightenment. What is that? What does that mean?
Well, I think it means different things to different people. For me, I think it begins with this understanding that we are more than our physical bodies. And if we are more than our physical bodies, then that impacts how we move through this life. It also impacts how we understand ourselves and what the limits of ourselves. You know, so often in our culture, we think that we are only as big as our skin. But when you have an experience of moving beyond the skin, then you're faced with all kinds of interesting issues like how big am I? You know, what am I capable of? What are my limits? And, you know, what does it mean to grow? And what does it mean to evolve? And so for me, enlightenment is begins with that journey of experiencing these outer limits of what it means to be human and to begin to embrace the non-physical dimension as well as the physical dimension.
When Hayward really Carrington deep. And Sylvan Muldoon were talking about out-of-body experiences years ago, they talked about an area, Paul, a level that you don't want to hang around in. It was somewhat demonic. It wasn't friendly. It was very uncomfortable. Do you experience that, or have you talked about that with the Monroe Institute? Is there this plane of existence, a dimension, a different level, where these entities that we don't want to be attached to kind of hang out?
Well, I think in our work, you know, we've kind of discovered that you'll discover anything there that you want to out there. You know, every human belief is represented there in one form or another. You know, the question is, do you want to take that seriously or not? And do you want to spend time there or not? You know, it's an interesting question because I get this a lot, this question about, you know, is there evil? And you have to worry about that when you go out into these domains. You know, we're raised on the idea that, boy, you better stay busy, because if you're not busy, then the devil's going to get in there some way. And you certainly don't want to relax and let yourself open to this kind of vulnerability. But what we've discovered is actually just the opposite of that. One of the marvelous aspects of this work is watching people courageously go into places where they might be terrified to go at first. You know, something frightening can come up for people, and usually what we do in our small minds is when something frightens us, we immediately put the label "it's evil" on it. But in our work, what we've found is that if people will, rather than running away from it, begin to consciously turn toward it and see what kind of a gift or a message it has, then that transforms the energy almost immediately. And so people can go into these realms and re-experience traumatic experiences that maybe they've had as children and see it from an entirely different perspective and come away from this reintegrating something that had been split off for many, many years. And that's where this work gets really rewarding.
You see the mystical experience as important. How come?
Well, the mystical, again is, I think, at the basis of every religion. When you look at the Old Testament, for instance, you know, you've got Moses who discovers this burning bush that isn't consumed, and somehow God's voice is emerging from it. You know, that's a mystical experience. You got Abraham who hears the voice of God, and he's called to go to another territory and just to follow that voice. Well, that's a mystical experience. David interpreting dreams, and Ezekiel when he has these visions of a wheel within a wheel, and different characters who've been swept up into the heavens and come back and talk about that, and then Jesus with 40 days in the wilderness and taking his disciples up on the mountaintop where he's transfigured, and then Paul on the road to Damascus, and that's within the Judeo-Christian tradition. But then you've got you know, Buddha under the Bodhi tree and having a mystical experience there, and within Hinduism, the same kinds of things. And so I think that why it's so crucial is that because these different traditions hold the mystical domain in common, excuse me, I think that's the beginning and where we have an opportunity to find out what we share in common. And I think that that's really the basis for peace in the future.
Paul, well, next hour when we come back, I kind of want you to take us through a course at the Monroe Institute from a novice who comes in and just kind of let us know what they experience, what they are going through as well. And then we'll talk about some more efforts to really channel people into an area where they can find themselves, because that's the big issue now as well. With our special guest, Paul Rademacher, he's the executive director of what is called the Monroe Institute, which basically explores human consciousness. And we'll also chat about how you can use this consciousness in your everyday life to change things for the better. I'm George Norrie. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. If you need to email me, that's george@coast2coastam.com as well. Don't touch your dial. We'll be right back.